a free Gaussian action with a nice, by introducing a metric on the worksheet and then gauge fixing it away. Something which I did not mention, that probably I should have mentioned, is that even when you gauge away some degrees of freedom, you still get the equations of motion, so the degrees of freedom are still something you should keep in mind. They give you constraints. Typically, if the constraints hold at some time, they will hold forever, but you still need to impose them to really make contact with the original theory. The equations of motion for the metric are the variation of the action with respect to the metric. This is by definition called the stress tensor. So classically, you're supposed to study the action in some locally flat metric, which is sort of but also impose a constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. And I invite you to have fun and check the classical. You can indeed find minimal surfaces of minimal area by solving the classical equations and then imposing this quadratic constraint. What is this stress tensor? In flat space is nothing else than this expression. But this is just such that TAA vanishes. And the fact that TAA, the trace of the stress tensor vanishes is related to the fact that it is dual invariance that we mentioned last time. OK, so for now, I want to focus on this problem. This is a quantization of this problem. And then we'll figure out how to impose these constraints. Imposing constraints quantum mechanically requires some work. The best way to do it is use the BRST formalism, although you can try to do it by hand sometimes and almost get the right answers. I don't know if you've done quantization of gauge theories, like electromagnetism. So you might have already seen some examples of situations where you need to impose a constraint. But I will go over it in the next lectures and do a little bit of BRST formalism that, you know, it's always good to get it early. okay. Now, how comfortable do you feel with free quantum field theories? What are the sort of things that you feel you can do with a free quantum field theory? I ask you, do this with a free quantum field theory. What? Give me an example of a this that you would know how to do.
I guess I can find the spectrum pretty easily, like just solve the equations of motion, find the phase space, and then sort of quantize. It should be pretty.
Yeah, you're right. Typically, you say, okay, let me take my field, expand it in Fourier transform it in space, so that each mode of the field is like an independent harmonic oscillator. Then I know how to quantize harmonic oscillators, and I get a Hilbert space, which has some ground state and a bunch of oscillators on top. That's right. That's a reasonable way to do so. And once you got your spectrum, what else can you do with it? So, say you have a Hilbert space.
I can add interactions and establish like scattering or something.
I'm free theory. I don't want interactions.
Okay.
So what questions you can ask to a free theory? Even just in a quantum mechanical system, right? Suppose you have an harmonic oscillator. Which questions can I ask on this harmonic oscillator?
Can copy the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, for example.
The spectrum?
The spectrum of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, absolutely. Suppose we had that. We had a Hilbert space and the spectrum of the Hamiltonian.
The expectation value of the position?
Sure, expectation value of things. That's right. I could ask, what if I put x at some u1? Mu2 at some u2, etc. How would you compute this? I mean, x admittedly is not a great thing to use. We'll do better, but how would you compute this? Yes, with contractions. As long as the operators are separate points, we know what this means. And we can write it as sort of a sum over products of two-point functions. And this is just a property of any sort of Gaussian integral. Whenever I have a Gaussian integral, correlation functions of my variables are factoring products of two-point functions. And how would I find the two-point function?
Inverting the equation of motion.
That's right. So there is this nice Swinger-Dyson equation that tells me that if I apply the equations of motion to that would be one way. So if I put this into the path integral, I do some integration by parts. We were not going to use this method, so I'm not going to discuss details. But you find that this instead of being zero, this is sort of a delta function. And so you can solve these equations with some boundary conditions and find your two-point function. Otherwise, as I was saying, you can express this as a sum of each of these fields as a sum of modes. And then you just need the two-point functions of the coefficients of these modes. And so you just need the two-point functions in the harmonic oscillator, which are pretty straightforward. That will do. So I'll leave you details momentarily. Now, which sort of challenges we're going to face when we try to do computer string theory amplitudes? Remember that, are we done? Well, remember, I was drawing pictures like this. This picture is supposed to represent the worksheet, the history of a collection of strings. And it's the place where those fields are supposed to live. Those fields describe the positions of each point in space-time. So the main challenge is we need to figure out how to study a collection of free scalars, two-dimensional free scalars, massless free scalars, on a surface of this type. these sort of tubes I'm drawing here are really sort of things that go to infinity, okay? They're not boundaries. So the input of a calculation like this is going to be a collection of states. So we had to learn how to describe the states of a string, which roughly are states for this 2D theory, in the sense I can cut. Imagine that this is time and this is space, Euclidean time and space. Then I have a 2D theory which lives on what looks like a cylinder for a while. Then the cylinder does weird stuff, and I have other cylinders. But when I'm on the cylinder, I kind of know what to do. In the quantum field theory, I say, OK, I have a bunch of states in space. And then these states evolve in time. So we had to figure out how to talk about the states and how to compute a free field theory, do a free field theory calculation on a weird surface where I have a bunch of these states coming in along infinite tubes. Now, that looks challenging. That is more challenging. But it's not too bad. How can I possibly deal with a situation like this? Well, there are surely a variety of methods, but one method is particularly convenient for applications is to use what's called the state operator map, which we will review in detail in a separate lecture. But the point is that we are going to convert the calculation like this, ultimately, to a calculation on a surface without tubes. So I will learn how to reproduce this, how to replace these tubes with a bunch of things happening at points. So the logical process we'll follow is going to be the following. We're going to learn how to talk about the cylinders. Then we're going to learn how to reproduce the cylinders with smoother things and how to do calculations on a sphere, because we don't care about loops for now. That's beyond our scope. OK, so as you can guess, so we'll have to sort of think a little bit about what are the sort of questions we can ask at points. And I was thinking to have a little bit of a discussion about that. Very brief, but I think it might be worthwhile. Now, what questions can you ask in quantum field theory? So here, we computed the correlation function. Logically speaking, it means that we had we asked a bunch of questions. There are a bunch of observables, roughly, at various points on space-time. And then we do the expectation value of that. What other things could I place at some point in space-time?
Could take like a product of operators since I'm in a free theory.
Right, I could try to do something like x mu x mu 2 at the same point. And then other things. Is this going to make me happy? Meaning, I can try to apply the same formula, right? But I'm going to get terms where I have two-point functions evaluated at the same position. That looks really bad. I mean, this is singular when positions coincide. So, there are some challenges. How do I talk about composite operators? How can I make sense of something like that? Or say something like that. We definitely know that we are going to need to be able to talk about the stress tensor. But the stress tensor has a square of an operator, of a field, sorry. that seems problematic. So another thing we'll discuss at some length today, hopefully, is how do I make sense of something like that? As you study quantum field theory, you learn something called normal ordering, which is a recipe to make sense of something like this. Normal ordering pretty much tells you throw away a piece. Normal ordering is something that only is well defined in free theories, and it pretty much tells you do with contractions, but don't include dangerous terms. Sort of drop contractions between within the operator. And there is a good reason you did this, is because you're working in flat space. And for flat space, this is a great prescription. But we will have to work with things like a cylinder. And we'll see that that's not really a great prescription, and we need to do a little better. OK. So, good. This is sort of the introduction. Now, what are we going to do today, hopefully? Any questions? If there are no questions, I'll start doing it. So, today's problem. We have a space-time, Euclidean space-time, which looks like a cylinder. Dimensional cylinder. And I want to define a free scalar, you know, something with that action on this cylinder. Let me give names to coordinates which are a bit more informative than U1 and U2. I'm going to call the direction along the cylinder tau, Euclidean time. If you want to remember that this sort of, if you want to make contact with Lorentzian perspectives on the worksheet, which is useful when you think about unitarity, then tau is sort of I times the Lorentzian time. And then I have a coordinate sigma along the cylinder, along the circle of the cylinder. And so sigma is going to be periodic. So I identify sigma with sigma plus 2 pi L, where L is the radius of the cylinder. As I mentioned last time, complex coordinates are often useful in this game, in two-dimensional wire-invariant theories. And so I'm going to define S as tau minus I sigma. Now, one of the advantages of complex coordinates is that equations of motion become just ds, ds bar, x equal to 0. So classically, a solution looks like, I drop the coordinate, the index for coordinates in space-time. I'm just adding one coordinate at a time. At the end, we just put all 26 coordinates together. So classically, you can solve the equations of motion by something like that, by the sum of an holomorphic and antihomomorphic function. If you were in Lorentzian signature, S would be something like T minus sigma, and S bar would be T plus sigma. And this would be a left moving and a right moving wave that move at the speed of light along the cylinder. So let's do the thing of Fourier expanding in space. and recovering harmonic oscillators. So I'm going to write the following expression. So you should think about this as a Fourier expansion in sigma, where I'm including the tau dependence that solves the equations of motions. I made a lot of a posteriori convenient choices of conventions. Right, I decided to put the 1 over n in front of the coefficients, that's my choice of convention, and so on. Notice that exponentials are such that this is periodic, sigma goes to sigma plus 2 pi l. So I'm getting a, because I'm on a, because space is a circle, the Fourier expansion is not, does not involve continuous momenta, but rather a discrete momenta that I call n. Now, if you sort of run to the rigmarole of writing equal time commutation relations between x and the conjugate momentum, a requirement to be something like this, as you probably did it when you were studying free field theory. Or if you, I don't know, if you just write the Hamiltonian in terms of these coefficients x, p, a, and a bar, you'll find that the natural commutation relations when you quantize the system are that x and p equal to I, an and a minus n are conjugate, and a bar minus n are also conjugate. Okay. So the center of, there is a center of mass degree of freedom because this field, scalar field was massless. The overall constant value of the field is just not, does not enter the Hamiltonian at all. Hamiltonian, P enters as P squared in Hamiltonian. We'll write the Hamiltonian later. So the center of mass of the string, in a sense, moves as a free particle. You know, this is just a commutation relation for a free particle moving along line. And then there are these oscillator modes, with, you know, a creation and a destruction operator for each mode. And there are two families of them, because I sort of left moving fluctuations and right moving fluctuations on this string. So we are sort of immediately able to write down the Hilbert space of the system, or the scalar field theory. Space of quantum states for this system, ignoring for now the constraint. So when you quantize them separately, when you quantize these, well, you know that you're going to get some delta function normalizable states labeled by momentum. So you can take a state which is sort of an eigenvalue of p and is also annihilated by all the destruction operators. And then we create excitations on that with the creation operators of the harmonic oscillators. So let me just list a whole bunch of states. Etc., etc. Okay, I gave you the Hilbert space as a vector space. I should still tell you what's the inner product. Now, remember that, unfortunately, momentum eigenvalues are delta function normalized. So we'll have something like that. That's unavoidable. Then I can use the commutational relations to get everything else. I assume you saw something like that for the harmonic oscillator, but let's see if you can remember it. Suppose I am doing something. So first of all, the Hermitian conjugate of something like A minus 1 P is going to be P A1, right? Creation operators are Hermitian conjugate to annihilation operators in the harmonic oscillator. So now I can ask you, OK, can you compute this inner product? Actually, for fun, let me put an N here. How do you do that? Yes, use the commutation relations. If you commute this across the other, this will kill that, and this will kill that. And so using the commutation relations, you get something like N delta P minus P prime. And then it's conventional here, it's just a convenient convention. Okay, and you can do the norm of more complicated things in the same way. Sometimes you'll have to work a little harder, but not much. You get a bunch of factorials and powers of integers. Any questions about this? Okay, so this is the Hilbert space of a free scalar on the cylinder. What can we do? Well, there are sort of two. This theory has an interesting property. It has a lot of symmetries. Well, just because it's a free theory. So the action is evidently invariant under a shift x goes to x plus a constant. Symmetry. X goes to x plus a constant. If you write the current for this symmetry, how would you derive the current for this symmetry?
I guess I would look at the action, right, and do the another procedure.
OK, let's do another procedure. Guide me through it. So I start from the action. What do you
do? I pretend that C is like a function. I know that it gives 0 when it's.
OK, let's do that. Pretend that C is not a function, it's a function. And then I'm just supposed to look at the coefficient of the first derivative in C, because the part that is constant in C will drop out. And the coefficient is the current. So there is a current, which is just the derivative of x. And why is it conserved? Well, because the conservation follows on the equation of motion. Now, something fun happens here, though. Let me write J in complex components. There's going to be an holomorphic derivative and an anti-holomorphic derivative. Now, suppose that I make a mistake of ignoring half of the current, and I just check conservation for the other half. So I'm going to do del bar J without doing the del J bar. Well, this still vanishes because of the equations of motion. So alternatively, you have one symmetry, shifting x by c. You actually have two symmetries because I have two currents. That's weird. More to that, suppose I take any function of s and multiply it by j. That is also conserved. So I actually have an infinite amount of symmetry in the problem, which is precisely shifting x by holomorphic or anti-holomorphic functions. Now, this is not a surprise in the sense it happens for every free theory. Free theory has infinitely many symmetries. But some aspect of this procedure generalizes a lot. So there are going to be a lot of situations where I have some conserved current in 2D in a conformal field theory. And I discovered that both halves are separately conserved and that I get infinitely many symmetries. So in two-dimensional conformal field theory, in two-dimensional Wallerian theories, there is a tendency for all symmetries to become bigger. And the underlying reason is that every theory that is two-dimensional and one invariant is invariant under reparametrizations of your complex variable. So there are sort of transformations of coordinates that you can do. They leave the action unchanged if you write your action nicely in complex coordinates. Simply because the Jacobian of the transformation kills the Jacobian from the transformation of the derivative. And sort of this infinite symmetry, which we'll describe momentarily, is called Virasoro symmetry. If you commute it with any other symmetry, it tends to produce even more symmetries. So in two dimensions, symmetries are cheap as long as you have any time you have some operator which is somehow holomorphic, you're going to get it. You can think about this as a conserved current of some sort, and multiply by any holomorphic function to get other conserved currents. So the fact that there was this beautiful symmetry with this current sort of suggests that this is actually a nice thing to think about. And indeed, this X itself is not going to be very useful as an operator for us. But on the other hand, we'll get a lot of mileage out of the operator del x and the operator del bar x And classically, if you write down the stress tensor, it looks like this. It has four, it has actually, in principle, the stress tensor has three components because it's symmetric 2x2 matrix. It's traceless classically, and quantum mechanically too in this theory. So one goes away. And the two remaining components are sort of the SS and S bar components. And they're just sort of squares of these currents. Okay. So in order to study this theory, in order to impose constraints and so on, correlation functions of these delects are going to be particularly important. So let's compute them. So how would go and compute, how would you go and compute something like this? So first of all, we're on the cylinder now. So when I talk about correlation functions, it's literally a situation where I put a state, I act on it with some operators, and then I have a state in the future. So I want to compute this. How do I do that?
I guess I could expand in modes.
Mm-hmm. So we had the mode expansion. When we write the mode expansion for del x, a bunch of things drop out. Actually, I del x is convenient. I get p over l plus 1 over l sum of n equal to 0, different from 0, of a n e to the minus n over l s. Okay. So here I'm going to get two contributions. There is going to be a p squared, potentially, and something else. So the p squared gives me just a minus p squared over L squared, and then I'm going to get a sum with some ans in each of these two. But in order to get a non-zero answer, the indices have to add to zero. So I really have one sum, not two. And also, I need to first act with the constructor and then act with the destructor. Otherwise, I get 0. And so there is a sum of n greater than 0, 1 over l squared, n e to the n over l s prime minus s. Of course, delta p minus p prime. Okay, and I can do this sum as a geometric series. Very good. Why do I care about this? Well, because the very first step in trying to figure out how to impose quantum mechanically that the stress tensor vanishes is to compute the one-point function of the stress tensor, for example. So I could do something like this. So how do I define this? I need a definition of the stress tensor, which will work quantum mechanically. So one strategy to define composite operators carefully is called point splitting. You separate the components of the operator and then do whatever you need to make sure that when you bring them together, you don't get a divergence. So, because at the end, an observable is just a recipe to do things in quantum field theory, a recipe to get a calculation which is meaningful. Any recipe to compute something meaningful will be an observable. And everything which you cannot give a recipe for is not something you can define. Right. Also remember, quantization is an art, not a science, meaning it's not like if you get the classical thing, there is guaranteed that you can quantize it and you can quantize it uniquely. No, there are always choices, and you need to be careful to make the choices which preserve the symmetries and properties you care about. So here now I'll make a choice on how to define the stress tensor on the cylinder or on general surfaces. So I'll define T of S as a limit. S is prime goes to S of minus 1/2 del X at S del X at S prime. If I do this definition, I'll get a divergence where S hits S prime. The question is, what do I subtract? If I were to do normal ordering, I would subtract this whole thing, pretty much. The vacuum expectation value, roughly, of the stress tensor. But I really don't like doing that. And I don't like doing that because L appears in the expression. And one of the beautiful properties of quantum field theory is locality. I define things locally. I can do otherwise. I can make definitions which depend on things far away from the point where which I'm starting. But that ruins locality. And so it's going to punish you somewhere, because locality is very important in quantum field theory. So I want to make a local choice. I want to make a definition which only depends on what's going on near S and near S. So in order to do something local, put the minus 1/2 outside, I will just subtract the minimum possible to make this finite. So this correlation function, wherever I am, no matter which surface I'm on, will always have a double pole as S approaches S prime. You can show it. You can go back to the definition using the Laplacian, for example, to figure it out. And so if I subtract it, I will have something which is manifestly positive, finite, no matter where I am. There is a price to pay for this, which is that this expression really uses an explicit local coordinate. On the other hand, the surfaces we are going to study are patched up together as complex manifolds with coordinate transformations. So you totally had to worry about the fact that the expression I'm writing in some coordinate system might be different from the expression that somebody else is writing in a different coordinate system around the same point. So this will turn out this will be manifested as an anomaly, meaning the stress tensor will transform in a surprising way as I change coordinates, but as the price to pay for locality. The alternative would have been to give a definition which really uses the shape of the whole surface. And then would have been very hard to integrate over the space of shapes, for example. Okay. So once we get the definition, we can do a calculation. Okay. we should take this expression, add the singularity, remove the singularity, and take the limit as s goes to s prime. It takes a little work, so I will not do it in real time. But it's, you know, you can ask Mathematica to do it, worse than worse. It's de L'Hôpital, nothing more than de L'Hôpital. And so you get something like, what is it, p squared over 2 minus, or 2 L squared, minus 1 over 24 L squared delta p minus p prime. Okay. So this term is particularly interesting. Suppose I go to the vacuum, so I don't have to worry about the p squared, the ground state. This is like there is a negative energy in my ground state, which depends on the radius of the circle. So this is called Casimir energy. And it's really a physical thing. See, the reason I so if you have a quantum mechanical system, typically your energy is defined at a constant. So they mean the word energy doesn't really have an intrinsic meaning. So it's up to a constant. But in a quantum field theory, your energy, you want your energy to be the zero mode or the stress tensor integrated over space, like the T0-0 component of the stress tensor integrated in space. And you want the stress tensor to be conserved and maybe traceless and so on. And all of these constraints affect, really give you a meaning, a stronger meaning to the origin of the energy. Meaning that if you were to, the only way to shift the energy by some random constant would be to shift the stress tensor by a constant. But if you shift the stress tensor by a constant and then you integrate it over L, your energy will shift by an amount that depends on the length in a specific way. So, and also you might lose Lorentz invariance or the definition of the stress tensor. So, as long as you define your stress tensor in a way that does not depend on the shape of space-time, then you get a, you know, a canonically well-defined notion of the energy of the vacuum and a well-defined notion of Casimir energy. Okay, this minus 1 over 24, right, is very important in a lot of things we're going to do. It ties into the sequel to the 26 dimensions too. There are other ways to compute it. Like you could have said, okay, what if I go back to the modes and I try to compute it? Typically, if you compute in terms of modes, and you get expressions like sum over n, as n goes from 0 to infinity, from 1 to infinity. And then the textbook will say, ha, we invoke the power of zeta function regularization and say that this is minus 1 over 12. Now, leaving aside the fact that it's not clear a priori why zeta function regularization would be the right thing to do, unless you've read some old blog post by Terry Tao that explains it, this is just the right way to do the calculation. So here you see that it really came from imposed in locality. It was a, you know, there was a good physical reason to get this number. Okay. So, anyway, more generally, once you define this stress tensor and we live on the cylinder, we can sort of expand it in modes carefully. Yes.
What other choices of regularization are sensible? Like, can we do dimensional regularization, or that doesn't make
sense? It would be very hard to preserve while invariance in dimensional regularization, because this theory is only while invariant in two dimensions. So my guess is that if you there is a risk of getting a TAA which is not zero in NIMREG. But at least you would have to perhaps subtract something non-canonical to make sure that this is, which looks non, I mean, you had to adjust the dimensional. If you do the dimensional regularization in such a way that TAA remains zero, possibly yes, but I don't know if it's possible. So you can repeat this analysis sort of in a more general situation to write down a Fourier expansion of the stress tensor. Well, this is now normal ordering in the sense of putting them in the first the destructors and then the constructors. So the modes, the Fourier modes of the stress tensor up to this minus 1 over 24 are denoted as Ln. And so you can do things now like compute the, there is a similar expression for T bar, for the anti-holomorphic part of the stress tensor. We call those T and T bar, which involves some L bars. Okay. I should stress that, right? I can stress it now. Let's continue. You can use this information now to find the energy, the momentum, and other properties of these states. There is also a definition that I was implicit here. Now, from now on, I'm going to set L equal to 1. I was including L in the calculation only to be able to show you the Casimir energy. Now we're done. The theory is conformally invariant, so the radius of the circle doesn't really matter and drops out of calculations. So let's just set L equal to 1. And also there is a useful definition that you call P A0. So that in this sum, there are terms involving P2. Okay, and so using this formula, you can, you know, totally compute any correlation functions that stress tensor and of other similar operators. If you want to define more complicated operators like the x cubed, the x to the fourth, or whatnot, you'll have to do similar subtracting exercises. What else I want to say today before we stop? Right. I want to just mention one final observation. If you look at the expression, it's clear that del bar t is 0. And again, del bar f of s, we'll call it v of s, t is 0. So, the stress tensor is like a current for some symmetry too. Well, we know what, it's translations. But stress tensor times any holomorphic function is also a current for a symmetry. This is the symmetry that maps S to S plus V of S. Or if you want the action of the vector field V of S del S. And this is there in any while invariant two-dimensional theory, not just the free boson. It's just the infinitesimal form of this reparametrization invariance. And now we could ask, so classically, these symmetries satisfy an algebra, which is the algebra of vector fields. So if I have something like V del S, V prime del S, you get something like V del V prime minus V prime del V the less. So the symmetry is close among each other. And you can ask if this remains true in this quantum mechanical setting. So is the symmetry still there quantum mechanically? We definitely expect it to be so, but we should check. And so next time, I would like to compute the quantum mechanical analog of this. In particular, if you just stare at the problem a little bit, you see that what I was calling Ln's correspond roughly to the e to the ns del s vector fields. And so we might want to compute Ln commutator Lm. And I can anticipate the answer. You get a term which is the same as the classical calculation. So it's really this expression applied to this definition. Is it visible? I can just raise it a little bit. I cannot raise it, apparently. Or maybe this is not a blackboard. Oh, I'm writing on the back thing. Sorry, I'm not supposed to. Anyway, but there is going to be an extra term. There is a 112 here, which has the same origin as this 1 over 24. And this extra term, this anomaly, you know, it's anomaly, whatever. Whenever something is classically true, is not true quantum mechanically, you call it an anomaly pretty much. This anomaly involves just a number, not an operator. So it means that when I do these transformations on a wave function, say, they close only up to a phase, up to a multiplication, multiplying the wave function by something. Now, this is very common in quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, the wave function is not a state, it's a wave function up to scale. So in quantum mechanics, it's very common that a symmetry that holds classically holds only up to phases quantum mechanically. This is called a central extension of your symmetry. It appears all over the place. Sometimes in quantum mechanics, you have a system, classical system, which has an SO3 symmetry. But when you look at quantum mechanically, only SU2 acts. Because if you compose rotations, you might get an extra sign. So that your rotations do not live in SO3 anymore, they live in SU2. So similarly here, there is some slight enlargement, slight modification of the symmetries of coordinate redefinitions, where you get extra phases controlled by this 1 over 12. Now, as I'm trying to glue up the surface using coordinate transformations, you can see that having these phases might be problematic. Indeed, these phases are just a manifestation of the fact that this system might have an anomaly, unless the number of dimensions is just right. So this number there is closely related to the Weyl anomaly. In a sense, it's a way to compute the Weyl anomaly, one of the ways. And you get a Weyl anomaly 1 for each direction of space-time. And if you have 26 directions, you get 26 there. And then there is another contribution from just doing quantization properly with ghosts and things like that, that throws in a minus 26. So ultimately, the theory that lives on the worksheet does not want to have this modification. Also because when we try to impose t equal to 0, effectively we are going to try to impose that these operators act trivially. And if the operators act trivially, the commutator clearly cannot have a constant. So the whole structure would make sense only if we can ensure that when we put all the ingredients together, this number goes away. OK, so next time I will just do the calculation quickly, and then we'll study the states of the string theory. Mm-hmm.
I have one question about that picture. So like,
Yes.
so Z operator state correspondence map. So like, the calculations in the amplitudes over integrating this like
Yes.
patched manifolds is mapped into like calculations in CFT or.
Yes, they are doing the CFT here or here. I'm just saying in the CFT, we'll learn a trick to avoid using these semi-infinite tubes and go to something like a sphere and then go to something like a plane where things are very easy.
I have a very random question coming from the previous class on CFT. So we found in the previous class on CFT that like when we have free field theory, even in the two dimensions, because of this existence of these vertex operators, we have like infinitely many primaries. And how does it complicate
Well,
stuff?
I have not discussed with you yet the list of all the questions that you could ask. So we discuss the question, the observable del x. We discuss observables poly del x squared. And you can get a hint of how you can talk about polynomials in del x. Now, when you study Peschken and Schroeder, you might get the impression that polynomials in your fields are the only things that you can ask questions about. That's not true. There are a variety of other things you can do because I said everything that you can make sense of is something you can ask. In this two-dimensional scalar field, there is other operators you can make sense of, which are exponentials of the fields. And so we'll describe them and we'll learn how to do calculations with them. And those are definitely important here. In other theories, you might have things like disorder operators, which are even more subtle, where operators which are defined by imposing singularities in your fields instead of putting polynomials in the fields there, or functions of the fields. So yeah, it's figuring out what is the list of local operators in a theory. It's not a trivial task. In conformal field theories, the state operator map helps because as long as you understand states, you also know how to understand operators. But that again, is something we will discuss later. And sometimes goes wrong, but not in situations we care about.
But I'm guaranteed to have infinitely many primaries, right?
No? The Ising model has three primaries.
No, like in strings, because this is free, no? So the
In this particular, the ground of strings moving in 26 flat directions, yes. I would say most string backgrounds, yes, because usually the Virasoro algebra sort of generates, acting on an operator, generates some tower of operators, but which is typically much smaller than the collection of operators, that's true. There are very weird string theories which have, finite collection of primaries, things like that.
I have a question, like, why does the dimension come to like 26 and like 10? Because these are like they when I do mod 8, they have like they are 2 mod 8, and there is some connection to like Majorana file. What was the deal about that?
So let's see. Oof. So have an answer in mind, which is okay, fine. The only answer I can give is that there is something called heterotic strings, where you have supersymmetry on the left and not on the right. And in particular, the central charges on the left and on the right are 26 and 10. But in any two-dimensional quantum field theory, conformal field theory, the difference between left-moving and right-moving central charges is a gravitational anomaly. The difference mod 8 is a gravitational anomaly. And so it had to be the case that the difference of central, left and right moving central charges was multiple of 8. Because you can write the worksheet theory of heterotic strings.
But I guess here it's zero, right? The difference.
No, I mean before you put the ghosts. Right. Before you put the ghosts.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So I'm saying the existence of the automatic string watch theory before I even put the ghosts sort of requires that C left minus C right is multiple of 8.
And then because I can connect the others via dualities, the others also.
No. But I don't know any other way to say this. So. This coincidence, I wouldn't know how to explain it except to say the automatic string exists.
But that explains it for the heterotic string, right? But it doesn't explain it for the strings.
Well, those words 26 dimensions, right, are not universal properties of string theory. They're just universal properties of string theory which admit a conformal gauge. So I have to be cautious about saying universal things. And so because it's specific to string theories which have a conformal gauge, it means that it's a property of conformal field theory, it's not a string theory, essentially. And then, yeah, conformal field theories can have any central charge. The only constraints you can find involve differences of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic central charges. Because that's a gravitational anomaly.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about our choice of curing the divergences here.
Yes.
So you said that we don't want the usual normal ordering because this is Jude's cell and
yes.
It breaks locality.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understood what you said correctly, and if I'm wrong, this breaks Poincaré symmetry, right?
No. Poincaré symmetry rotates S by a phase, and so S minus S prime rotates by a phase. So the stress tensor will rotate by a phase, but that's fine because the stress tensor has two S indices, so it has to rotate by a phase. So this definition is invariant under translations and rotations, and it has subtleties when you look at other coordinate transformations.
Yeah, that's the part that confused me. The other you mentioned.
Notice that this vanishes when n is 0 or 1.
Yes.
And L0 defines rotations or scaling transformations, and L-1 defines translations. So indeed, these anomalies, these issues only appear when you look at more general coordinate transformations.
Yes. Does it break diffeomorphism?
Well, diffeomorphism is not a symmetry, but diffeomorphisms that can be erased by wild transformation are a symmetry, and those are the same as this. So these are diffeomorphisms which can be erased by wild transformation, which are also called conformal transformations. So there is an anomaly in the conformal symmetry, which really comes from an anomaly in wild symmetry.
Okay. So. Are we really sacrificing anything from our description by this choice of regularization?
I don't know if it's called a sacrifice. You're making a local choice. The price we paid is that there is a Casimir energy.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question about like the non-critical string. So if you do not mod out like violent variants in that TA,
mm-hmm.
then like do we still integrate over moduli like when we compute amplitudes or something? Because now it's not like diff mod wild, I guess. Right? So,
well, now you're integrating over the wild factor and over moduli.
Oh, okay. So
and then you treat the wild factor as if it was a scalar field on the worksheet, as one of the directions which has a funny action.
Okay.
At least that's one perspective on it. So non-critical strings can be recast as critical strings with what's called a linear dilaton on the ground.
And so what is the reason why people just don't take like 4D plus Liouville? Is it because the Liouville is doubly coupled or something?
No, you can do that. Just you get a space-time which looks like five-dimensional with a big wall. The thing's cut off. The thing. Then you need to check that it's unitary. I'm not sure it is. There are some issues potentially. So unit, you know, if imposing requiring unitarity might be further constraining. Then there is the tachyon also. You can possibly do non-critical superstrings. I can't remember if they're unitary or not. Like you can put a superlu wheel and four directions, and I don't remember if this is a unitary superstring theory.
I see. But the vault would be in the fifth direction, I guess, right? In like the Liouville direction? Or?
Yeah, well, there will be a fifth direction, which is the Liouville direction.
The wall in the fifth direction.
Yes, yes, at some point.
So we could be living on some like slice and not feel the wall, I guess.
Right. Yeah, you don't get a universe that looks like ours out of that. You could try other things. Maybe you could put something with shoe. I don't know. Not sign Gordon, unfortunately, it's not a CFT. But right, as I said, you can take four flat directions and some random CFT to describe the rest. And you get a four-dimensional look in theory. This is what Calabria compactifications do, and you can do other things.
Has the Liouville theory at like central charge 22 been solved, or
Liouville theory is solved at any central charge.
Okay.
So, in principle, you can compute any correlation functions. In practice, it might be challenging. And as I was saying, there are unitarity issues. Because unfortunately, I think Liouville theory is probably unitary only if the central charge is greater than 26. There is a, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, so if you want to have a nice unitary spectrum, you need to see bigger than 26, which doesn't quite work. Yes, it's unfortunate.